Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Michael.
How you doing?
Oh, pretty good.
Yeah?
Although I woke up this morning with that orange glow in the sky, and it's like, oh no, the fires are burning again.
Now, do I have it right? You're up towards Monterey or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So are the fires close, or is the smog just coming down your way?
I think the closest fire that's still burning is in Big Sur right now.
Oh no, they have another one in Big. I mean, they've been through the years. Big Sur has been affected by fires a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Where are you?
I'm actually in Riverside, California, which is,
Really?
yeah, you know where that's at?
Yeah, actually, I got a scholarship to go to Riverside and I didn't go.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I was born and raised in the Inland Empire. I've been away, left for a few years, but for the last 35 years I've been back. I've been trying to get out of here, but finances and stuff, and so I guess I'm meant to enjoy the land, as Gary Snyder says, the place you're at.
Place you're at, yep. Morning, Steve.
He has his mute on.
Yeah.
Oops, sorry. Good afternoon, Lisa.
That's
Afternoon
right,
here.
it's afternoon there.
Yeah.
Steve is in Atlanta.
Oh, wow.
Already getting hot here today.
My bad.
Well, we had 2 days in the 90s and now it's back down to cold and foggy.
I
Yeah,
take cold and foggy right now.
yeah.
After summer in the South, absolutely.
It's actually cool in the Inland Empire. We had a over 104 or 105 days over 110.
Where are you, Michael?
Riverside, California,
Ah, Southern Cal.
about 60 miles southeast of LA.
Yep, I know it.
Oh.
I used to travel with my job everywhere. So
Oh,
yeah.
okay. Okay,
I
cool.
know the OC.
Okay.
I saw that Denver went from over 100 degrees to snow in 2 days. Did you see
Yeah.
that?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Oh my God. Well, hi, Marco. Hi, Ed. Oh, hi, Rick.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi there. So, Marco, after we get started there, I noticed there's still a few people who have not like joined the group to get emails and things. So I'll ask you just to explain to them how to do that, and that way they'll get the assignments regularly and that sort of thing.
Sure. I
The
saw a few
meetings.
people signed up over the weekend as well.
Yeah.
Well, we'll post this video by tomorrow, and then we can direct people to the link to where they could see it. And then hopefully we can just clarify how to participate, because I know it's been confusing for some people, but here we are, so it is possible. It's just following the right pathways to get here.
So, Rick, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. We're expecting a snowstorm.
Yeah, hard to believe. 100 degrees to snow.
Yeah.
Are you in Colorado, Rick?
Yes.
I'm in Longmont.
Oh, really? I'm in Windsor.
Oh, okay. Just up a bit north, up right. 25.
Right.
Okay. So you've probably also been getting the smoke and the ash.
Correct.
It was snowing ash here a couple nights ago and a bit yesterday. And there were large plumes of smoke coming over from Loveland, I believe, west of Loveland.
Yeah, just above Fort Collins, Cameron Pass.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the largest in the states. I mean, not that fire in particular, but the one from the week previous was, I think, one of the largest in the state's history. But this is like small compared to California, which has already reached, I believe, 2 million acres burned, which is right. a record. And it's not yet the peak season for fires. So it's pretty, like when you start seeing ash falling out of the sky, it starts, and the sky becomes kind of this weird purple, this weird amber color, and the sun is like phased
orange.
Out. Yeah, it's really creepy. It's really eerie. It's like apocalyptic.
So, Ed, how are things in Germany? Are you...
Today it was sunny and warm. Tomorrow it's supposed to be sunny and been dry, which is unusual, but we've got near drought for about the last 3 years. So it looks like we're going to stay dry. But
no fires.
Oh, no. There's lots of rules here. People tend to obey them.
Oh, you mean they don't set off pyrotechnics to announce the sex of their baby in the middle of a, dry grassland?
Pyrotechnics are reserved for New Year's Eve. And then everybody in the country, except our household, has some, and they set them off. It's a little. There are cultural differences, that is for sure.
Yeah. All right. Good morning. Good afternoon, everybody. Hi, John. Hi, Kate. Hi, Michael. So we got a bunch of like really late signups recent, like in the last 2 days of people I don't know. So I'm actually excited to meet some people I don't know. Because I know most of you, except for Michael. I don't think I've met you in person. I would like to just, since we're going to be on this journey together for a good 3 months, to have everybody just share a little bit about themselves, what their interests are, how you know me, if you want to get into that, just to, so we know who these Hollywood squares are on our screen. So would anybody like to start? If not,
I'll start.
Going to designate.
Hello, okay. Everybody. Welcome. My name is John. I live in Manhattan. I met Lisa, 3-4 years ago at the Gebzer conference here in New York. And we struck up a lively dialogue at that time because I had some very weird experiences that I was not able to articulate particularly well, especially in a public space. And a lot of what Lisa was offering in the presentation she gave, working with paradox and the paradoxes of language and communication, just really, resonated at a very deep level. And I was astonished and delighted that we shared so many different references, like Stephen Rose and then anything to do with Klein bottles. It was a mutual fascination with, and it was just so nice to like meet another person who was interested in such weird stuff. So I read Lisa's novel, and I loved that novel because it really did, I think, create conditions for the kind of presentation that may be happening right now. So thanks to all of you and each of us and both of us and whatever combination of us happens during this journey together. And I'm really glad we've all created the conditions to make this happen. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Who's next? Kate?
I can go next.
Go ahead, Michael, you're not muted. Kate, you're gonna have to unmute yourself.
Yes, I'm camping and I hope I'm not disturbing somebody's peace. But I'm in Maine. My name is Michael Klimov. I usually go by Misha. It's my Ukrainian-Russian nickname. And I know Lisa from Monterey Youth Center. And when I lived in Monterey Bay Area, I attended it in person, and now I continue to attend it virtually, which I'm very grateful for that group. I'm very interested in language. I am a foreign language teacher in linguistics, and there's four chapters I read, and it's like many thoughts I had about like oneness and separateness, how we are, our egos is the main problem of separation, and so a lot of interesting ideas and thoughts that this reading has provoked. Okay, I think.
Thanks. Kate.
My name's Kate Reynolds. I'm an art teacher. I'm interested in mythological languages and the way that images, metaphor, myth works. I'm doing a lot of writing on what that has to do with art, but I'm interested in general in Hermetic philosophy and the way Jung was essentially made Hermetic ideas kind of respectable for the 20th century. But I came to Jung, the Jung group that Lisa belongs to, which is how I know Lisa. And I am interested in Jung simply because of his connection with Hermetic philosophy. So I'm less interested in his clinical ideas than I am in that. And I joined the group because language works symbolically. Like, I mean, all languages, the map is not the territory. Raw experience is what is. We invent maps and symbols and narratives and see patterns, and I'm interested in the way those work. So that's why I joined the class.
Great, thank you. Good to have another female presence here, Kate. Steve?
Yeah, hey, I'm Steve. I live in Atlanta. I'm a retired businessman. I know Lisa through Zoom meetings with the Jung Society of Monterey. I wish I could attend in person. I think I say that every meeting, especially in the summer in Atlanta, or I'd be happy to be in Maine. My interest is primarily in Jung, and I'm on an inner journey here in my retirement, and reading a lot of philosophy, and reading Jung, and reading Hillman, and a few other folks, some of the classics, and I'm just trying to grow and learn more. And I come from an environment in the business world where our language was usually reserved for four-letter words. So excuse me if I don't understand some of the words you're using.
Well, always feel free to ask, okay? I don't want, you know, things to just go by, you know, because we have a nice, intimate little setting here. And that goes for everybody. If I'm saying stuff that, you know, doesn't resonate, stop me.
Okay, I can go. My name's Ed. I'm in Germany. I'm an American expat living over here with my family. All of my kids were born here, which is one of the reasons that the family's here now. We're all back together again. I've been involved on the site here for a few years now. I got started with a reading we did on Jean Gebser and kind of got stuck here like a fly on paper. And I run a few cafes myself. Lisa's been involved in a couple of them, so we know each other that way. So we have a wide spectrum of interests that we kind of share. And I'm interested in the topic. I was, like Misha, in one of my previous incarnations, a language teacher. So that's always been something I've been very interested in. I also studied applied linguistics here in Germany when I first time I came over. So that's how it never gets, once you stick to something, you never get it out of your system anymore. So you just have to learn to live with it. And that's what we're doing now.
Thanks, Ed. Who's next?
I guess I'll go. I know Lisa from the Jung and Gebser Society meeting in Monterey, and also through John Dotson and basically the Gebser Societies. My background's in healthcare business, and so I took this class primarily because I don't know anything about linguistics or language, so that's pretty much it. Thank you.
Perfect. Okay, we got three left. Michael, Marco, Jeffrey.
I'll go. So Marco Morelli, I'm in Longmont, Colorado. And I also know you, Lisa, through the Gebser Society. I think we met in person here in Boulder, 2018 or 17, I believe yeah. It was. But I started this forum, Infinite Conversations, and the journal Metapsychosis, I think coming because I'm a poet and because I'm very interested in language and the deep structure of language and the kind of primary assumptions that we make when we use language, or perhaps when language uses us, or both. And what I like about what you're doing is that you're sort of bringing attention to those deep structures and to like what is really going on, the mystery of what is going on when we, you know, when we participate in this medium. And so I'm really delighted to see all the faces on this screen. I know you're real people too. You're not just little rectangles on my computer screen. And I hope that over the next few months, we'll get to like deepen our sense of like co-participation in this mystery of language, which I think is so compelling and profound and important, because as you say in your work, in the introduction to the Consciously Evolving Language book, it's how we shape our world. It's how we bring forth the world that we experience. So how that happens, I'm looking forward to exploring with all of you.
Yes, and thank you to Marco for setting this up and being the guru, the web guru.
That's the only
I
kind
really
of guru
appreciate
that I'm going to be. And barely that.
I'll go next. My name is Michael Stump. I live in Riverside, California, or better known as the Inland Empire in Southern California. I don't know if this is accurate, but I start from a place of speech, not language, because I had a speech impediment and not being able to express myself because of my speech impediment and the way people interacted with my impediment. I know language is connected to speech, but to me, speech is the raw being able to voice whatever the fuck you're gonna voice. and try to do it with some kind of real and connection. But, you know, learning how language works probably has helped me dance with my speech a little bit better. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Oh, hi, folks. I'm Jeffrey Edwards. I live in Quebec City, Canada. So I live and work in two languages at the same, you know, more or less together. I was an academic until last year. Still have grants, a few. But these days I'm writing full time, so novels. So language is pretty hard to avoid in what I do. I have done some, haven't invented a language, but I have certainly invented words for my science fiction books. So that's an area. And I've known Lisa both online, and we met at Boulder a couple of years ago, the same meeting where Marco and where I met Marco in the flesh, as opposed to just on screen. So, so I enjoy being around Lisa. I think you're a fascinating person. And so I'm really looking forward to taking part in this journey with you guys. Well,
great. Well, thank you all. And you reminded me, Jeffrey, of a question I wanted to ask people before we got started. And I think I know the answer, but maybe not. Who has another a language other than English as their first language? Michael Klimov. Does anybody else have, Jeffrey, you're fluent in French?
Yeah, I'm fluent in French, but I learned it later on, not from birth.
And
I would report something weird that I feel that my primary language is not the one that I am able to speak very well. My mother tongue, my mother's language was Spanish, and that was the language she spoke to me in as a baby. So I feel that it's very neurologically deep, maybe deeper than English. But I grew up in a totally English-speaking context and only heard a bit of Spanish. Like I can understand most of it. So that's me. I think it's an interesting, I don't know, situation.
Yeah.
Russian is my first language, but I was born in Kazakhstan, and actually it's the like different kind of Russian. Like there are some words that we use. Like when I meet my people from my motherland, it's interesting. Like I recognize my accent changed when I moved to Ukraine, where I grew up, and I went to Ukrainian school. So I have like my Russian, that's my mother tongue, is different Russian, and Ukrainian became my second language because I had all my schooling done in Ukrainian. Yep.
Okay. Ed, is German a second language? Do you speak German?
Yes, I do. The reason I came to Germany is because while I was avoiding the draft back in the early 70s, I managed to escape by enlisting and successfully negotiating to learn German as my MOS, my military occupational specialty. So they sent me to DLI after basic training for 8 months, and I learned German before I did my advanced training, and then I was stationed in Germany. So that's how I got here. I was about 22 when I learned German, but that's the primary language that my world consists of. We speak English here in the house, and for the most part, but my son-in-law is German, so he only speaks English when he has to, or when refuse to acknowledge what he's saying in German. For the most part, it's German these days.
Okay, Kate? Unmute yourself.
I just had a question. Is it Misha, Michael?
I'll go by Misha. I don't know how to change name.
I should know this, but I don't, because I lived in Central Europe a long time. But, what is the difference between Ukrainian and Russian?
Oh, a big difference.
Is it a largely different? I thought there were different variations. No?
No, not at all. That's what many people think. But, well, like the month of the year, very quickly, the Russians is Yanvar, Fevral, Mart, Ukrainian. Sichin, Luty, Ukrainian is like month are descriptive. They describe like what happens during this month. Like, and many, many differences. Like if you, I think the Ukrainian is closer to Polish, Slovak, than to Russian. Ukrainian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the reason I asked that question is because, I only have English as a primary language. I learned a little French in high school, picked up a little Spanish to go to Argentina, you know, but English is pretty much all I can talk about with any kind of authority. And so if there are differences between what I'm asserting about English and what you know about other languages, by all means, bring them up, because that's, I think, part of an inquiry that needs to happen. And we'll get into, a little of that in our next session in particular, when we look at Worf and Jakobson. But I just wanted to make it clear that, you know, anytime I'm saying something and it does not jive with, you know, what you know about your other languages, bring it up for discussion, because it would be an interesting thing to talk about. So, that's why I wanted to bring that up. So thank you again all for joining, and welcome. How I'll go through today, I'm not gonna assume that you did the reading, although knowing you guys, you probably did. And we'll just talk about some topics. And the way this course is going to work is we're going to kind of spiral back on things. You know, we'll bring up something today and then we'll go on to other things. And maybe next week or the week after, you know, we'll come back to something and expand upon it and do a kind of, you know, circumambulation. It's not going to be a linear, you know, like first you learn addition and then you learn subtraction and then you learn multiplication and then you learn long division. It's going to be much more kind of roundabout, and the idea isn't to, you know, like learn content. It's to question. It's to look at things about language and about ourselves that, you know, maybe we haven't spent a lot of time looking at. Maybe you have. Everybody's different. In order to build sort of a foundation for then asking, you know, how can we bring some consciousness to helping ourselves evolve, you know, psychologically, spiritually, by helping language evolve too, because we're going to look at some of the, you know, the limitations of like English, and how those might be keeping us kind of stuck in a certain mindset or paradigm. So So that's kind of the broad layout for this course. A little more background for why this now. The bigger picture is that I am working on another book that is not as far along as this one, which I am going to, you know, propose some actual ways to what I call take language broadband. But this one came first. If you read the intro, it was my blog. The blog crashed. I looked at it as I was recovering the files and thought, gee, it seems more relevant now than it did 10 years ago when I started writing this. So perhaps as we discuss this, you know, more ideas, more things will come, and I'll add to this, and hopefully, you know, get it published eventually. If not, just having the opportunity to discuss these things, I think, is valuable in and of itself. So so let's start in chapter one, which was the original homepage. I said, sorry, my print is really small here. In the second paragraph, I'm talking about paradigm shifts. So a few short centuries ago, our ancestors faced a similar type of shift, which seems oh so obvious today. They shifted from thinking the earth was flat to thinking the earth is round. Today, we are faced with a similar but different shift, from thinking that we are each separate to thinking that we are already always interconnected. Okay, so I have two, well, no. I want to say something about paradigm shifts first, and then I want to ask you about already always interconnected. So first, just to be, let's be clear about what a paradigm shift is, because I'm really trying to say that, you know, we need one. But with the work I do with scientists, I realize that not a lot of scientists even understand what a paradigm shift is. So you all probably do. It's from Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where basically a paradigm is a set of assumptions, a set of methods, a set of operating principles for doing, you know, a certain type of scientific inquiry. And a shift in that is, it's a radical alteration of the underlying assumptions such that new types of questions are able to be asked. So in the sort of Newtonian worldview, you know, you can ask certain types of questions about, you know, how objects behave with respect to, you know, gravity and other things. But then when quantum physics came along, you get to ask entirely new sets of questions. That's what I would really like to happen with regard to language. I don't know if I can make that strong of a case, but that's the kind of case I really would like to make, is to be able to ask new types of questions about what language can do, and what our relationship to languages. Does anybody have any questions about that? No. Okay. So now I'm going to ask you a question. Okay. The last part of that thing I read was about shifting from thinking we're separate to thinking that we're already always interconnected. So just to you, what does it mean to you to be already always interconnected?
You know, like when I was reading your chapters, on my mind was the gender question, because most languages are so gender hooked on gender, like Russian big time. Like that, for example, like now when we have the you can identify, you know, he, she, or they, or, and in Russian it like wouldn't work almost. Well, like they would be Russian, like sound. If I, it's well, there is neuter gender that is very old. It's disrespectful, like when you would call someone. They also like ironic or sarcastic. So I was thinking about how can it, like Russian or French language change? Well, Russian, especially because I have more feel like it wouldn't work. Or Ukrainian. Yeah, but well, to me, so this is like one of the separations, gender separation. It's like very, and everything is in languages I know, my mother tongue, everything is hooked on gender. So it's like to avoid it. So this is like the society assigns roles. This is already like big separation. And but in a like a global sense, I thought about that. Well, I was thinking for me, like when I have like hostility towards other people, like why do I have that? So I question this. And it all comes to that I kind of like fail to see their humanity first. I fail to have compassion first. So I think this oneness would start from this seeing each other, that we are going through the same. We are all suffering and we all deserve compassion. Like to me, that's like the big thing that I've been working on. And the language here, I thought that the more that should be, if it starts with language, it could be there could be a change, because the language is so important.
Yeah, Kate. Unmute yourself.
I think to get outside of one's own paradigm, you know, think outside of the box, you need to investigate the construction of your worldview, the modern worldview. And the modern worldview thinks that mind is local to your skull. And of course, the Jungian view is that mind is non-local and that we're kind of swimming in a collective mind. And that, I think, is crucial to transcending the idea of our separateness. But added to the complication of that is the idea that we live on different ontological levels, that language is constructed in different ontological levels, and that you have to identify the level you're on to know, to be understood, essentially. But the ontological levels integrate as they climb, you know, thinking alchemically. I'm thinking hermetically here. That
could you just for other people, could you and me too, just say a little more about what the different ontological levels are you're referring to?
Go back to that old koan that asks what's the sound of one hand clapping, and the answer is that it's like two sides of a coin. You can't choose one or the other, but if you get above it ontologically, you can see that it's one coin with two sides. That's the way reality integrates into something single. And then the alchemical process is always that you separate properties out and recombine them into a higher reality. So we live on different ontological levels. I mean, just take the idea of sexuality. It can be bestial and it can be divine. You know, it can, it's taken on different ontological levels. And when you're to the tantric level, you know, you've merged all disparate or to discrete categories. So if you're talking about taking language up, I think you have to acknowledge that language operates differently on different ontological levels of reality.
Yeah, that's a good point. Michael and then John.
I feel like I'm out of my wheelhouse a little bit on this subject this way. To me, it's noticing how language is used to objectify people and get caught in solidifying how things work. There's very solid ways. I work in maintenance and I work with my hands a lot. And so I have to touch and feel objects. And I've been around different types of people that in maintenance that you can tell that their language is being used as an object to slam the shit out of you. So to me, that's where I'm just acknowledging that language has this really part of it that wants to treat life as an object to do something with. And I don't know if it fits into what you guys are talking about.
Yeah, it fits in really closely. It'll become, I mean, we're going to be talking about this type of thing on and off a lot. Okay. Yeah.
That's just how everything's landing on me. I'm just reporting back.
Great. Yeah. I just want to welcome Mika, who just joined us from Monterey.
Hi. Thank you for having me. Yeah, sorry I was late.
That's okay. We're discussing the bottom of page one to top of page two, just on, you know, paradigm shifts and looking at what does it mean to be already always interconnected.
And okay, thank
John
you.
John is.
This question actually makes me sick to my stomach. But I don't want to re-traumatize myself or anyone else here. I go all the way back to when I was 12 years old, and I was looking up the word homosexuality, and I read everything I could on that topic. And there was a broad consensus, scientifically based, all social theorists agreed, homosexuality was a sin, it was immoral, it was criminal, and it was pathological. And homosexuals are doomed to drug addiction, prostitution, alcoholism, and they cannot love. Okay, as a 12-year-old, this really depressed me, to say the least. And I started a project. And I worked very carefully with lots of different people. And we were, and the gay movement then was extremely underground. As I got older and was able to leave the South and come to New York, I met many allies and friends, and we created a culture. I bristled at the idea that we were a subculture. A subculture means you're underneath another culture. And because I didn't want to be a member of a subculture, I wanted to be pre-mainstream. And I knew that if we try to fight the status quo, we will lose. We have to do something different. And we did. And the differences, I think, that we made that made a difference was the way we used language. And we did it very deliberately. And we moved from homo, which is pathological, to gay, which was much more friendly, to queer. And then to trans. And it wasn't as if there was a committee meeting where we all sat together and made these vocabularies up. It was much more fluid and dynamic than that. And to give an example, I think if we juxtapose different kinds of concepts, we wake up to how fluid our concepts are. So there was same sex over here, marriage over here. And then we said same sex marriage. So we brought them together. And that made some people cringe. It created a tremendous phobic response, the idea of bringing these two together. But we said it, we repeated it over and over and over, 1,000 times a day for 30 years. And now the Supreme Court has changed the law, and same-sex marriage is available to, you know, anyone who wants to engage in that institution. I do not particularly, but I defend the right that everyone should have access to that if they wish. So I think this is a concrete example of how you can use language. You can take concepts and juxtapose them, and it rewires the nervous system slowly. Sometimes it takes decades, but those who, I had a charming little a friend of mine, he was 10 years old. When he heard same-sex marriage, he went, yuck. A very visceral, ooh, I don't like that. And I was very gentle with him and like appreciated his model of the world. But then the story goes that his friend, he had a cousin. No, it was an uncle actually, a close relative who lived in a different state where same-sex marriage was legal. And he got to know his uncle and his uncle's husband, and he liked them. And so he had to deal with that weird feeling of being in between in this liminal zone. And of course, now he's a grown man, and he has a totally different worldview than he did when he was young. But I'm just offering that as a sort of case study in how the way we use the language can recreate our psyches and our somas, because this is very somatic re-education. When we use language, it changes the way our bodies feel about ourselves and about others. And there's something else I wanted to say, but I think it's slipping out of my awareness right now, and I'll come back to it, I'm sure, as we circumambulate, I think you said, Lisa, that idea. We'll come back to this at another time. So thank you for this opportunity to put this really difficult stuff into words. And I don't feel so queasy in my stomach anymore. I feel very relaxed. So thank you all.
Okay, I think Steve and then Jeff.
Yeah, so I have been playing with the idea of oneness versus separateness for quite a while in my head. And I'm finally starting to, with all the reading and talking to other people, I'm doing finally putting some words around it. I also have an interest in astronomy and cosmology, and if you think of the Big Bang, if you accept that theory, which is the big scientific theory, although there's coming up with some other ones, we all did start from the same stuff, so it would make sense that we would be one, right? And then I got into the Jungian stuff with some of his concepts and collective unconscious, and kind of supported that as well. So that's where I come at it from. I think this is a huge challenge, though, just to talk about what was John was talking about. Yes, we've changed the laws on, or the Supreme Court has changed the federal law on same-sex marriages, but there's an awful lot of pushback in this country. And I think in this country, changing any paradigm about individuality versus community, this is probably the worst place to do that, because individuality is, you know, that's American, right? And this idea of community is more of, we think, more of an Asian kind of a cultural thing. So we're gonna have to change the culture to do that as well. And I think that's where a lot of the, you know, talking about language, a lot of the pushback on political correctness has come from with the Trumpians. I'm not gonna talk politics, but just that pushback against the Obama era came from this whole political correctness, which really was about language. And I don't know, I'm not hopeful, but I'm optimistic that you'll figure this out, Lisa.
Oh, it's not going to be me. It's going to be us with a capital U. I can't do it all by my lonesome because we're swimming in it. We're swimming right. in language, you know, and it structures our world. This is why I was asking about what languages people learned first. Because when you learn a language, you're essentially also learning an ontology. You're learning the way the world is made up, the way the world is related one thing to another. And those assumptions get ingrained before you develop the capacity to question them. And so, yeah, individualism is a very American assumption that we learn, you know, by osmosis, practically by imbibing it. Anyhow, okay, Jeff, you had your hand up.
Yeah, so it's the kind of question where I kind of want to crawl into my shell and say, "Why I'm not going to say anything because it's so large. I feel like even adventuring out at all is difficult." So, a couple of things. One of the things, though, I've been interested in lately is what is unsayable. So, you know, doing a lot of work with Aurobindo and spiritual kinds of questions. And a lot of that part of the world seems to be, you can certainly talk about it, but I'm not sure that you actually get at the essence of what you're trying to say by talking about it. It has more to do with nonverbal ways of talking about those things or unsayable things. So I'm very interested in I think that's part of a discussion about language and paradigm shifts, is what is unsayable, what needs to stay unsayable, and what can be included in language. The other thing that was the discussion about gender and the way gender language is shifting. So this is an area, so in my science fiction novels, I have seven biological genders, if you like. And so I actually use a neutral term, not they, them, because they, them is a kind of non-specific way to talk about two genders or two plus genders, let's say, because I don't think it's just two genders anymore, but in the understanding of these things, but it's an it's a lack of it's an inclusive specification, if you like, whereas talking about seven genders is a multiple specification. So I use a neutral term here, she, instead of he, she, her, him, to talk about those genders. And I don't think that they, them works for me in that context. So there's a subtle difference in the way one talks about gender using they, them versus a specific pronoun. So that's I have an interest in that discussion. And it's partly a little bit like Johnny's interest at the level of queer, gay, homo, because I don't feel gender masculine. I'm sitting on that boundary myself. It's a very personal and very real question for me. So, the issue of language around gender is something that I'm still struggling with in terms of the way it's being done or handled in the general thing. So I think these things are beyond my control to some extent, but I have feelings about these things.
Rick?
Could you repeat your question again? Because I just wanted to clarify my comments based on what your question is.
The question is, what does it mean to be already always interconnected?
And that to me strikes it, the language creates this sense of separation. So if we're, where we put our perspective tends to separate where we're focusing away from what we define as what is whole or connected. And I think it's a matter of seeing it as a piece of a larger whole, in the sense that when I'm taking on or focusing on one perspective, I may be separate, but at the same time, I'm whole, because I'm just expressing and using that creativity to express something that comes out of the wholeness. So in that respect, our language tends to, in modernity, tends to make us separate, because it becomes so mental that it's not as embodied. I guess that was my quick thought on that. That's all.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm wondering, I mean, wondering in this whole book, if there are ways to kind of get language over that hump of separating us. But, I don't know if there's an answer, but.
But is it the assumptions or the limitations of the language that creates the separation?
That's a question that we're going to be diving into, or is it assumptions about culture, or is it assumptions about, you know, other things? Yeah, all good questions. Kate?
Separateness, I think we're referring to what Jung called the ego, which is necessary for us to know which mouth to put our fork in. But I think that the transcendent idea of saying things that are ineffable, that Jeffrey was talking about, Marco probably knows more about, he's a poet. And that's where you use language and metaphor, and by juxtaposing images together that transcend the limitations of logic. So we need our egos and we need that separateness for our own evolution, evidently. But talking about those realities where we are connected, I think it transcends the rational and goes into better and better metaphors, depending on how well we do it. What do you say, Marco?
I'm going to take a moment for silence and just let the discussion settle a bit, because part of what I think we could bring our attention to is like the subtleties involved. The whole idea here, consciously evolving language, to bring it right back to the very kind of starting point. It's an interesting phrase, because is there a subject? Like, who's consciously evolving language? I think it could be easy from one ontological level, let's say, to make the assumption that I'm consciously evolving language, or we're consciously evolving language. But you could also put language into the position of the subject and say, understand that phrase to be saying that language is consciously evolving. It's just what it's doing. And of course, like, language is not, well, what is our, and our meaning referencing ourselves here in this group, what is our relationship to that language, which is already consciously evolving? We can, I think, take some different pathways in thinking about that, but I just want to bring our attention to that right there, because when we talk about language, like, it's already a tricky and sort of like acrobatic move, because language is what makes distinctions in the first place. So if I make a sound, or, and I point and say, and you all look in that direction, and then this sound I make, resonates in some way with your own receptive kind of capacities, your own architecture, your own biological architecture, your attention is shifted. Like, we're participating in language, but I'm also bringing your attention away from wherever it might be. And I'm creating a distinction subtly between that thing over there or, and everything else. So to talk about interconnectedness and separateness with language, I mean, I want to kind of say, well, we can't do language without separateness because it's all about making distinctions. And at the same time, when we share a distinction, that brings us together. So that creates an interconnectedness. And I mean, part of what I appreciate about what you're opening up here, Lisa, is that there's not necessarily a problem to solve. Like we can frame this rather like as a kind of, we have to evolve language to make it better, to make it adequate to a purpose, which is one way of like what John described earlier, like the conscious use of language for a political agenda. That's one mode of relationship, but it's not the only mode of relationship. We can also see it as a creative opportunity just to do something that's worth doing. And also it could be that there's a stack of possibilities where on one level, it's something that's a creative opportunity and it's worth doing. On another level, it's a life or death necessity. We have to do this because if we don't sort of disentangle ourselves from the assumptions that are causing us to act in separative, like act on assumptions that are self-destructive, then we're going to, you know, undo our whole living situation on Earth. So like as a poet, what I want to do is explore different combinations of words and explore like dance with language. Where does it want to go? Where do I want to go? And like play with that circumambulatory, that kind of cyclical and psychic, connectivity. I hope that's helpful a little bit. I mean, that's my response to it because interconnectedness is unavoidable. Even when we're presuming separateness, we're still interconnected. And at the same time, our interconnectedness is not a blank unity. It has a lot of distinctions to it. And what language allows us to do is to explore and clarify and creatively work with those distinctions.
Yeah, so what you have all brought up I'm going to reframe it in terms of an either-or perspective and a both-and perspective. And for a long time, let me just back up and say, back in college, I started becoming aware of that my own perspective tended toward kind of a both and I saw, you know, either or, you know, this sort of distinction making as if, you know, things were like really separate, as being kind of deficient, you know, until I realized that, yeah, you know, we wouldn't be able, I did this thought experiment once where I tried to, you know, like combine all of these antinomies, you know, and so, you know, you can start with, you know, self, other, and then you can combine, you know, just keep working up the ontological levels, as Kate was saying. And then you get to a point where there's like, everything's included, but you get to silence. Like there are no more distinctions to be made. And I realized at that point that the PhD thesis that I was attempting to work on was basically going to be about silence and how the hell was I supposed to write about that? I ended up not going down that path. What I learned later, though, was that I was still holding on to this either-or point of view by putting either-or, you know, like in one circle and both and in another circle, and, you know, like making some value judgments, until I realized that either-or actually goes inside of both and. That both and is sort of like a larger category that either or is a part of. And then on a planning call, John Davis there said, well, what about neither nor? And I saw neither nor, which is sort of like the void that is the source of being. So that encompasses all of them as well. Where was I going with this? Oh, so in terms of like separateness and interconnectedness and boundaries, I think it's important because language is about making distinctions, as you said, Marco. We also will do well to look at what's a boundary. How do boundaries function in, you know, in our world, in our language? Do they exist? If they exist, what is their nature? I like to do thought experiments and one of them was about like where do I begin and where does space, you know, like this, the boundary between me and the world. And when I went into that imagination and, you know, went into my skin and saw that, you know, my skin was not, even though it looks like a pretty firm boundary here, you know, there were gases and molecules being exchanged and, you know, things coming in and things going out. And, you know, it got to be quite fractal. And it's like, oh, there really isn't a boundary, is there? I mean, there's not like a boundary. It's just something that I assume because I've got the words for it. So, you know, I'd start asking other questions, you know, like where else are there boundaries that just seem to be there because there's a word or there's two words that separate, you know, X from Y. Is there really a boundary between them? So let's talk a little bit about boundaries, since that's kind of the direction we seem to be going. You know, what is separate? What does are separate and interconnected, you know, like actual, are they just conveniences, you know, are things actually separate? Are things actually interconnected? What assumptions do we make about separateness and interconnectedness? Let's just take a few minutes with that. Yeah, Michael.
Well, yeah, I was thinking wrong, Michael.
Sorry to Michael.
I'm Misha. No.
Okay, I'll call you Misha, and Michael Stumpf is Michael, so we'll go Michael, then Misha.
Steve also wanted to ask some of our talk.
Okay, and Steve.
I actually have a question that might help us before we get into it, if you don't mind, Misha.
Okay. Go ahead.
The question is how are you defining language as words? When Kate and Marco were talking, it struck me, I've been working with a Jungian analysis for a couple months now, and as we talk about my dreams, I'm realizing that my unconscious is developing a language with me, or we're doing it together to understand. So that just sparked that question. If you could define what we mean by language.
I'm going to leave it open. You can mean whatever at this point, whatever you want to mean by it.
Fair enough. Sorry, Misha, please go ahead.
Well, I was thinking about the languages that I studied and just differences. Like the languages really reflect their different worldviews and different realities. Like if the Eskimos have, I don't know how many words for snow that describes different qualities of snow, or the deer, whatever is. So it's that, I was thinking about Ukrainian language that has very, very peculiar sense of humor. To understand that, you have to know Ukrainian, and it's like we really know a lot, like the sense and humor in all languages. Like how, I was like, this is something that language represents. And there are also the misuse of language, manipulations that language is used to manipulate. And what's more important, I'm thinking, is that what assumptions we make about different other cultures that represent different languages. Like we wouldn't know until we know so much. And so this, it probably will be impossible to know all the, and like I lived in Thailand or in Turkey, and I also realized like how there were many moments when I had this, wow, it's totally like just different ways of looking at things. And but the misuse of language and the judgments that we put on the, like even with the definition of homosexuality, that someone acts as if someone owns the reality of others and puts this frame, and then if they have power, political power, then this becomes the norm, and people are manipulated into being. And I think what's more important, like for language, our identity is still like it's separate, but it's still very important to know who we are and like what I represent and what influences I have from, like, to know what where my bias is coming from and all that. So just thinking out loud.
Michael?
Yeah, so I'm going to respond from my experience of being a maintenance person, because that's kind of where I have to come from. And the use of words is like the use of any tool. And making assumptions about the word boundary or that distinction seems to come with two ways of looking at it. It does separate, but it also shares something with the other side. But we neglect the sharing. That we've kind of just spaced it off, but the sharing is already there. There's no, that's the always, everything is interconnected, but then we space it off, you know? And that is from my understanding, a mental rational stage that Gebser talks about. But I personally feel in reading Gebser that we're still working with the magic of making distinctions. of creating power with this environment, or, you know, how human beings have come to live in an environment that let's face it, I'm using my imagination, but probably way back when, it wasn't a very nice environment. It's still not nice, but it's different. So I'm just kind of dropping down into the magic of what we're talking about in terms of language, that magic property that sometimes we neglect to be responsible for, from my point of view.
Yeah, Kate. Unmute yourself.
The first translation of the I Ching into German was made by Richard Willem, and Jung always believed that the energy, the project so compromised Willem's health that he died of it, because the effort of changing a German world paradigm from that particular point in history, very scientific, and German is quite specific language, that having to change his entire internal world by changing into the way Chinese people thought in order to do the I Ching compromised his health beyond repair. I always found that an interesting point. But I had another point to make about boundaries, in that in chaos theory, there's this idea that you can't know the distance of the British coastline, because you can measure it, but then if you go down to the street level and start measuring it, and you go around every little corner, then it's longer. And if you go closer and you're going around every little rock, it's different. And if you go closer, and it's actually a matter of scale, and Lisa was kind of talking about that with where her boundary ended. In chaos theory, boundaries are permeable, and it depends on which scale you're speaking on, because there really is a completely different mysterious thing there. But at any rate, I think that metaphor is what we're talking about with language. The way we use language is always going to be in some sense symbolic. We're speaking with symbols, and it's the way that we use symbols and which level we're using it on.
Yeah, when I was in graduate school, I had to review the book Metaphors We Live by George Lakoff and Mark Johnson, which is a classic. I highly recommend it. Because they talk about the metaphoric basis of everyday language. So we know poets use metaphors very consciously. What they were saying is that even language that we think of as literal has a deep metaphoric basis. And I kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, it's metaphors all the way down. And in some ways it's a big house of cards, you know, but that's just my opinion. I don't want to foist that on anybody. But we're going to be looking at metaphors, specifically, you know, through the lens of Lakoff and Johnson. I forget which week, 5, kind of mid course. Because that's one area where we can start to be very conscious of the metaphors that we use, and what the set of associations that each metaphor brings with it, and the value judgments and associations that also come with the various metaphors. And we can, that's one easy way to start playing with, you know, changing language a bit. by introducing new metaphors. So yeah, we'll be coming back to that, you know, again, circumambulating, going, taking things round and round. Okay, Jeff, and then John.
I was in listening to a radio broadcast the other day about a group of scientists who have working with AI, and they were analyzing, they had an AI algorithm look at neural network, look at scientific papers. They had them look at 3,000 scientific papers. And what the AI was looking for was pairs of words that were associated with each other inside these, so the statistics of pairings of words inside the scientific articles. And they developed a kind of meaning map of these sets of associated words. And then they used that tool to mine new ideas that were implicit in the scientific papers, but nobody had recognized. And they used this as a tool to develop new approaches, new methods, new ways of thinking about what they were looking at, which was material science and constructing new materials out of what's already out there. But it struck me because it's very close to the ideas that I worked with Marco and Heather Fester that we presented in the Boulder meeting, which is what I call quantum poetics, which is this idea that words have a kind of connectedness between them. And so meaning is, so at the same time that language categorizes the world, meaning is constructed through these fields of words connected to each other. And so meaning is by its nature interconnected. It can't be constructed by categorizing. So this is why, although I agree with this idea that language categorizes and divides up the world, I think it's a bit like the fission-fusion thing in human psychology. We are both people who need fission and we need people who need fusion. And language has categorization, but it also has interconnectivity in it. You can't say it's just about categorization because of all these connections in it. So anyway, yeah.
Let me make one quick comment, John. So you've pointed out like what is key for me, which is that there is this both and, there is this separated, you know, this act of separating and then the act of solve it coagula. I mean, it's so basic. I maintain, this is my hypothesis, that the structure of English anyway, and perhaps it goes to other, you know, SAE, standard average European languages, that the structure of the language favors a worldview of separateness. In other words, we don't have a syntactic way of saying, you know, both separate and interconnected. We have two separate concepts, and we have to use all these other words to join them to say that they are interconnected. I tried to, for those of you who've read the novel, I tried to, you know, invent something new to build that paradox into language. I don't think I succeeded very well. We won't get into why quite yet, but anyhow, enough of that. John.
Thank you. Well, this is sort of very fuzzy for me. I feel like I'm ontologically flooded right now, and I will do my best. We had a conversation, I think, at the Getzer Society, Lisa, about when you were speaking about integral And when you're speaking from
integral.
Yeah, or the aperspectival. When are you speaking about the aperspectival? And when are you speaking from the aperspectival? And I answered with saying, I said, I can only respond to that metaphorically. When I am speaking from the aperspectival, I am a Klein bottle. Okay. And I want to, I think it was mentioned earlier, someone was talking about working with dreams and the boundary between the conscious and the unconscious. And just to refine some of our language here, conscious or unconscious, conscious and unconscious, neither conscious nor unconscious. I don't know exactly how you would diagram all that, but I have some ideas. I think the neither nor would perhaps contain both and an either or. That's very tricky. It's extremely fluid. And I say this because I've had the direct experience in, because I'm a practitioner of yoga nidra and dream yoga and lucid dreaming. I've had lots of out-of-body experiences, what some people would consider very non-ordinary, but for me it is sort of ordinary because it's been happening for years. But it's been very almost impossible to put into words to satisfy, I think, good communications with those of us who are primarily in the 3D, in a 3D orientation. Whereas I'm operating in 5D, sometimes 9D, in these hybrid states, which are neither conscious nor unconscious. And there are different ways of communicating to other entities, other intelligences. And I have often had this experience of saying, could you speak in English? Because when I go back into 3D, I want to remember what's being communicated. And sometimes they will. Sometimes they will speak in English. Sometimes they won't. And their communication is much more like music than it is like speech. In these spaces, I hardly ever deal with writing. I can write in these lucid states. I can write my name. I can write my address. I can write my social security number. I can do simple addition. So I can write, but it isn't something that I can't read. I get very dyslexic. So I'm looking at the contrast. I'm able to compare and contrast different states of consciousness with other states of consciousness. And I have where the boundaries are, it's very fluid, but I have spoken Mandarin, a language I know nothing about, except I had a boyfriend who spoke Mandarin. But in this, I've had these lucid states where I was speaking Mandarin, people were speaking Mandarin to me. I had a mother who was Chinese and I had two brothers. I have no conscious memory of this at all. But then another episode I had last night, right before I worked intentionally with the Throat Center, because I knew we were going to talk about communication today in language. So this is traditionally the Throat Center is where communication happens. And in my yoga practice, I visualized the Tibetan symbol A, the color red, in my throat center. And I drifted off into sleep. And then I would come back to the throat center and I'd notice where the A was. And I'd wonder, where am I perceiving this from exactly? And then all of a sudden, I heard this radio blasting to the right. And it was a song in Urdu. The singer, the vocalist, female vocalist, was singing Urdu. I was pretty sure of that. And it was flutes and it was a strange kind of percussive rhythm. And my thought was, oh my God, this is gonna wake up the neighbors. You know, I have to turn off the radio. And then I realized, wait a minute, I'm asleep. I have no radio. This is not being produced by any external source. It's coming from my nervous system, a very subtle version of the nervous system. And other episodes, other things started to happen. And I started to ask very consciously formulated questions in English of these intelligences, which were putting together, I felt in a very creative way, something that was neither conscious nor unconscious. And I felt this almost powerful sense of movement, like an autonomous intelligence took over my vehicle. I'm using a metaphor here of like, if you've done any work on your computer and you're getting assistance for a repair problem and someone will take over your computer remotely to work on that problem, it felt like that. That another autonomous being took over my vehicle and demonstrated certain things that I could do with this vehicle that I don't do. One of them was moving very quickly without going anywhere, which is in English 3D, really bizarre, but it was the experience that I had. And once again, I come back, and lots of other experiences happen, but once again, I come back into the regular organization, you know, brought about by living in Manhattan for all these years, with all the habits and proclivities I have, but with something added to that, which I'm rehearsing right now in this experience here we're having together, we're sharing together, creating the conditions, I hope, where we can be very fluid with our language, so that I'm not just talking about, I am talking from, very directly from something that I have not integrated yet. Hopefully I will someday. But I don't think, I agree, we're not alone. We can't do this by ourselves. Because language overlaps with our soma, our psyches, our history, our culture, our past, our futures. So there's no way we're going to be able to do this coherently without a different kind of skill set than we have now. So to me, this opportunity, this adventure I hope we're all on, is about building skills. And I think to me, boundary is very much like a threshold. And if you go over the threshold and you black out and you have amnesia, very, very little use, I think, is in going over thresholds that you didn't have amnesia for. You go, oh, something happened there. What was that? You know? And I think we are collectively, our species, this is not a new idea, is suffering from advanced amnesia. We are basically blacking out most of the time. And I think if there are enough of us who are paying attention to those transitions between those liminal zones that don't have to fragment us or re-traumatize us, this is my hope, that we could then start to evolve our language to accommodate these very non-ordinary, so these sort of meta-normal or other than normal. It could be a paranormal, and maybe one day will be quite the new norm. So that's my expectation and my hope. So thank you for this opportunity to sort of rehearse something that's in between the perspectival and the aperspectival. But I think it's where are you perceiving your perspective from? That to me is a pivotal question right now. Before it was like all about perspectives. I'm not that interested in the perspective. I'm interested in where are you perceiving that perspective from? Which is a very different kind of set of boundary conditions that question sort of poses. So thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, thank you, John. Thank you for presencing non-ordinary states, because it's very relevant. I want to be very conscious about the time. This is from 10 to 11:30 my time, so we're at 11:30. I want to leave you guys with a question for next session, which is in two. So how this is going to work is we have two sessions like this that are, you know, dialogue where we, you know, talk and, you know, and then after the next session on Tuesday, 2 days later on Thursday, I'm going to lead like more of a workshop format to get us into, you know, an embodied, you know, a doingness, an embodiedness, you know, just like taking this out of the mental sphere and, you know, like grounding it. So that's how it's going to go. Like two sessions of discussions immediately followed by a workshop, and then two more sessions of discussions immediately followed by a workshop for four cycles like that. So the pondering I want to leave you with is from the bottom of page 7 through like the middle of page 8 in the book. Can you imagine being a self-conscious cell of a supraconscious organism? Free will doesn't go away, and you're aware of a will that is beyond yours, into which yours can flow or not. Imagine being a cell in a finger and getting the call that the skin on the nose itches. A response is automatically coordinated through the hand and the arm to get you and your other finger cell buddies, with the help of arm cells, over to the nose to scratch it. And all that happens seemingly effortlessly, in flow, so to speak. What can this body of humanity, and even the body of the earth, including humanity as a whole, accomplish with you accomplishing your part and everybody else, all the other cells accomplishing theirs? What grandness could the earth human organism be up to in the universe? I don't know of many people who have asked that question, let alone tried to answer it. I'm going to leave you with that to think about for the next session. I'll let Marco talk for a bit about being on the group list, which is the easiest way to like get the next assignments and readings. So next session, read chapters 5 through 7. From Consciously Evolving Language. And then I'm also going to send you an article by a linguist named Guy Deutscher. And I'm going to send you chapter 1 from Stealing Fire, a book by Stephen Kotler and Jamie Wheel. So that's what we're gonna do next week. Marco, do you want to speak a bit about the list?
Sure. I'll just talk some logistics. First of all, thank you so much, yeah. Lisa, for leading this and making it happen. I also feel like John ontologically flooded in a really good way. I feel that this is this is like just fuel for creativity. And so thank you all for that. Regarding time, historically, I think there's another boundary question. Historically, the cafes we've done, these like Tuesday meetings, can go up to 2 hours. I think it's helpful to have a fluid boundary. So if we stop it after 90 minutes, if some people want to stay on, this Zoom line is available. And I wouldn't cut anybody off who wants to stay on. But that doesn't require anybody, including you, Lisa, to stay. So just so you know, the Zoom line is available. If anybody wants to continue the conversation, even at another time, and wants to schedule something and have a kind of, micro group and, do a deep dive into some specific question, totally welcome to do that. I'll provide information on the forum, Infinite Conversations, on how you can schedule something. Because we are paying for the Zoom line, we might as well use it if you want to use it. And the main thing, for me, my perspective is we're creating a field of possibilities and actualities. So I think that these conversations are interconnected. And I think that seeing the patterns between them begin to reveal new kinds of information. And so to just get back to the logistics, those new probably signed up through Metapsychosis. That's kind of like the journal aspect of it. That's the publishing tentacle, if you will. Whereas Infinite Conversations is a forum, and it's where we can carry on a discussion in text but also video and audio insofar as we include this media. So there is a group, kind of like on Facebook or other platforms, you can form a group of members. So among all the forum members, there's a subgroup for consciously evolving language to which everyone here has been added. And as new members join, they can get added to that group. And it's kind of like a list. You can remove yourself if you want to leave, or you can opt in, and then you'll receive any messages that Lisa sends. But then these recordings will be posted publicly and have a dedicated discussion topic. So we all can continue, or anyone else who wants to can create an account. It doesn't cost anything. I mean, we're paying for it, but nobody has to, you know, sign up or pay any money to just participate in the conversation. And once they join, this video will be posted and the topic can unfold from there. And then each session will have its own topic in the forum. Like I said earlier, we'll post this probably by tomorrow. But then with regard to publishing on metapsychosis, what we'll do is, because you submitted this to our call for submissions originally, Lisa, and then that sparked the idea of, well, this, let's do a conversation series about this, which John actually catalyzed. So what we'll do is, when we begin publishing on metapsychosis again in October, we're going to schedule in kind of like a serialization of these chunks of the text that you've, you know, the whole text with the relevant recording and then the discussion along with it. And then it'll have kind of a second wave, because as it gets published there, other people will see it and, you know, will promote it on social media or wherever. And others who want to participate in this project are welcome to do so. I've gotten the feedback that it's a little bit more complex and complicated, and I can't help that. We're all doing our best. I am going to open up just a channel for feedback. So if anyone here notices ways that we can simplify, that we could update our own way of having the conversation, that's what this is for. That's why it's an open platform. This is an attempt at a kind of meta and a collective level to create the conditions for having the kinds of conversations that could allow us to consciously evolve language. So I think it's all interconnected, and I look forward to seeing you all again in 2 weeks, which will be when the next session occurs. Same time, Tuesday, 10 a.m. Pacific, 11 Mountain, 12 Central, 1 Eastern. And if you're in another country, there's a timeanddate.com will help with time zones. Okay, any questions?
I have a question about the beginning and the ending. And if people want to stay on and continue to talk, that will be where does the recording stop? Does it stop at the end? We're finished, goodbye everybody. Whoever wants to stay in chat, that's fine too. But if you're going to stay in chat, are you still going to be recorded and it posted on YouTube? I think I would like to figure that out, because there may be a private conversation people might want to have that they don't want on Facebook or somewhere else. That's why I like the idea of a beginning and an ending is pre-established, and the recording will start and stop. And anything after that could be very interesting. And I'm not saying I wouldn't stay and continue, but I'm also saying I need a boundary. Okay, good. And I also have other things to do, and I know everyone else does. And there's something about, if you can just fit it in this frame, this time frame, I think the quality of conversations are much higher. We just let them go on and on and on and on. That's my personal vibe, but everyone else can have a very different one. Thanks.
Well, just quickly, I mean, I think what we could do is stop the recording. Those who stay on can decide if they want to start it again or if they just want to talk. Is that all right with everyone? Okay, great. Okay, so there we go. We've used language to come to an agreement.
Nice, Marco.
We're making progress. All right. thank you, everybody. And
thank you.
Till next time.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you all. I learned a lot.
Good days to you all.
See you next time.